Welcome to the Drum History Podcast. I am your host, Bart Vanderzee, and today I'm joined by Dan Garza again for part two of our Peisty History episode. Welcome back, Dan.
Thanks. I can't believe we're doing this again.
I know. This is, honestly, it's different than most other episodes, because usually it's, you know, one and done, but I think Peisty's special, and I'm really, really glad. It's pretty cool to, like, to do this, where we've had a week. Today is Saturday, November 20th, so this is only a couple days before we will release this, but to see people's reaction, and I've gotten a lot of messages, a lot of cool stuff from people just saying how much they've enjoyed it, because let's be honest, that was a long episode.
Oh, yeah.
So, people are really interested in Peisty, and as they should be. It's neat to get this information out there, thanks to like Fritz and this long list of people who maybe we'll, you know, shout out at the end. But I think it's cool to finally put it all together. How are you feeling after part one is out in the world? Are you happy?
Oh, yeah. It's, you know, there's just so much information, and listening to it, it was like, man, I'm going on forever. I've gotten feedback. I've been working with Fritz over the last week. We've been focusing on mostly, trying to find something about pre-war Peisty.
Yeah.
Some actual documentation or proof, you know. But, yeah, I've had a few people contact me and offer some information, which is really interesting. Just little tidbits here and there. But
yeah,
definitely helps with the whole timeline.
Sure. And, you know, maybe it's worth saying this, too, that, like, if you're listening to this right now and you didn't listen to part one, you just know that, like, that. All right, so the first one was basically about the origins of the family, up through, you know, the different factories and the moving around Europe and the being refugees and the Ludwig connection, which on that note, I want to give a big shout out real quick, though, to Jim Catalano, who on Facebook has been posting some really cool pictures of Bill Ludwig with the Peisty family going back when it was, you know, they were traveling together, and really neat stuff. So thank you to Jim Catalano for his continued support. He was a longtime Ludwig employee, and he's got a really cool episode on his with him on the show. So, yeah. All right. So, Dan, why don't we start off? I know the benefit of having this part two is that we've gotten a couple corrections. One of them is from Norbert from Meinl, and a couple, you know, different things where he loved the episode, but there was some stuff where he said, hey, this isn't 100% right. Here's the correct information, and I know you've got some other ones. So do you want to start with the housekeeping section, and we can clean things up a little bit that maybe got, you know, again, we have the benefit to do it now. So I'll let you take that away.
So I keep this is obviously a living, breathing thing as far as trying to learn about the history of Peisty. And, you know, I have several sources, and it's really difficult to find anything that, pre-World War II. And honestly, there isn't anything that I could find.
Yeah.
What I did realize, I made a major error in that Peisty was working with nickel silver way back in easily the 30s, if not the 20s. And the proof is that their gongs were made from nickel silver. And it can't be understated, you know, how important Peisty's gongs were to their business and their success. But my understanding is the Stambuls were always nickel silver. I don't have an official start date. And honestly, I don't think anybody really knows when Peisty started to make the Stambul series. You know, the timeline that I have says 1932, but because there's no documentation, there's no way to prove that 100%.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing I found too of searching pre-war catalogs, all these different drum manufacturers, is I found Zilco's pre-war, and I thought, oh man, they had a second line. And then I found out that wasn't a second line. Those were A Zildjian seconds or rejects that they just labeled Zilco and sold as a lower price symbol.
Yeah. Which is sort of a gray area too, because it's like, what's the definition of like a second line? Because that's,
yeah,
you know, but I think that's good to clarify that it, instead of it being a, this is a second separate line that is created from scratch for this purpose, not just oh, that one didn't quite make the grade, or it's not the right whatever. So here, now it goes over here. It wasn't specifically created.
Yeah.
All right. So then shall we discuss Norbert and the Meinl difference there?
Yes. So basically, my understanding is that the Profile and Ranker series were not the first B8 symbols that Meinl produced. They actually were producing B8 in the 70s, which I believe was the King Beat series. And they also released another model called the Laser. So, you know, I was definitely in error as far as Meinl's history. So I apologize for that.
Oh, that's all right. And again, Norbert was super nice and was like, hey, Bart, hope you're going to have a good time at PASIC coming up, which was fun. That's my PASIC recap. It was awesome and it was a great time. It was good to see everyone there. But which I mentioned in the last episode. But yeah, then he was just, you know, here's a little bit of information. No big issue. Just wanted to give you some facts. And again, super nice. So now I think we're good to just jump in and pick up the timeline, right?
Yeah, I was thinking if it's okay that we could do a real quick lightning round.
I love it.
Of factoids. And a lot of this is information I've picked up in the last week that doesn't really fit or was in the old part of the timeline. So
sure.
I could go ahead and start with looking more into the relationship between Ludwig and Paiste. What I found is that traditionally in Europe, there is a city called, and I'm going to try to pronounce this here, it's called Markneukirchen in southeastern Germany, right on the Czech border. And that was the center of production for musical instruments for centuries. And they would have a huge music fair every year. This goes back well into the 1800s. It was basically the European NAMM, the 18th and 19th century NAMM for Europe. And all the major manufacturers went there, including the Zildjians. Now, this would be the family that produced K-Zildjians pre-war. And Father Paiste, Mikhail, would definitely have gone there to sell his gongs. And there isn't concrete proof, but, you know, speaking with this is something that Fritz brought up, we're pretty certain that both Ludwig Sr. and Mikhail would have been there. They would have met. They would have at least, you know, exchanged business cards, but they knew each other. And the reason why this is important is because in the previous podcast, I mentioned that Robert Paiste had mentioned in his interview that the Ludwig family had sent them care packages right after World War II. So they knew who the Paiste family was. And the only way that would have been possible is if they would have done business or known them before the war. So that kind of wraps up that little tidbit.
Yeah, good info.
Another interesting factoid from the early 50s, and this was actually in Robert's interview, was that Father Paiste Mikhail had received a call from a salesman. This is probably right around early 50s when they started using their hammering machine. And he received a call from a salesman trying to sell them basically an automated machine that would produce the symbol in, I guess, one fell swoop. It probably would stamp it and then had another function for hammering. And the salesman was trying to sell it to Mikhail, and he replied, a machine for making cymbals, you can forget that. We don't make pots and pans. We make cymbals. And what ironic is the salesman that was trying to sell this the machine to Father Paiste was Roland Meinl.
Oh, wow. That's funny.
The founder of Meinl.
Yeah, that's awesome. Cool.
Okay, another tidbit. The Paiste Drummer Service, which I mentioned briefly on the last podcast with Robert, was headed up by Pierre Favre, I believe is the correct pronunciation of his last name. And he was the driving force for decades behind that. I believe it was Robert's idea, and he basically started it, but Pierre was the one who headed that project. Hmm. Pierre also was the lead symbol tester, from what I was told, for decades. He was the main symbol tester. There's also pictures of him in the old Ludwig documentation of when Ludwig went to visit Paiste and pick out symbols. Pierre was there working with Robert Jaeger, pulling the symbols out and explaining them to him. So he was like the number one like technical advisor for Paiste.
Wow.
The other person who needs to be mentioned is Freddie Studer. And my understanding is that Freddie and Pierre were key people as far as the development of new symbols. My understanding, and this is new information I got, is that Pierre was responsible for cup chimes, the bell, extra heavy bell cymbals, and it goes on and on and on. But those people are obviously key to Paiste's creativeness.
Yeah.
Another thing, real quick, is Swiss metal, as we spoke in the last podcast, was originally called, their name was Metalwerk Dornach AG. Mm. And AG is the same thing as Incorporated. That was Swiss metal's original name before they became Swiss metal, who produced, I believe, B8 and B20 for Paiste up until 94. Mm. Weilenwerks took over the B8 production. And I found out through Fritz from a firsthand account. Fritz was at the Sabian plant in Canada. Weilenwerks supplies B8 to Zildjian and Sabian for all their B8 cymbals.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Hmm. Wow. Man, you've done more and more homework.
Okay, well, I've got one more. Sure. This is an industry one. So Fritz is a friend who is a huge Bonham fan. And this German gentleman, Fritz told me, was constantly badgering Eric Paiste about finding Bonham's endorsement agreement. And he badgered him for God knows probably years. Eric finally gave in and went in and went to the archives and found Bonham's endorsement agreement, the contract, and basically the inventory list of what cymbals that they gave Bonham. When you go to Paiste's site and you see the picture of the endorsement and that inventory list, the reason why they basically, not that they don't have it, but the reason why they can actually produce it is because this German Bonham fan pestered Eric's, you know, incessantly until he actually went and found it.
Man, that is awesome. That's such history, that document.
You know? The other thing that this, I don't know the gentleman's name, Fritz does, obviously. He also pestered Paiste. This would have been around early 2000s. He pestered Paiste to do a special order and to make him a set of giant beat cymbals, which they weren't producing at the time. So Paiste went ahead and did that. And one of the things I understood with Paiste is that if you do a special order, you have to order two of everything. Mm. So there is two complete sets. And right after they produce the cymbals, Steve Jordan, who is famous because he used to be the drummer for David Letterman, yep, and he's been a Paiste player for decades, he was in Knotwell and he saw the giant beats that had just been produced. And he went over and he was talking to one of the Paiste guys, says, "Well, what is this? Let me play with these." So he really liked them. He said, "Well, I want a set too." They're like, "Okay." So they made him a custom order set. He takes them back to LA, and then a bunch of his buddies see him. They're like, "Well, we want them too." So they started doing all these custom orders for giant beats. That's how giant beats, the main reason why they're reissued was the demand.
Wow.
And it was originally started by this big German Bonham fan. And
that guy, we owe a lot of, you know, I mean, that's, it's really cool though, that something could be so, you know, loved long ago and then brought back because one person, maybe there was a couple people involved, that's just benefit of the doubt, but like one person was so passionate that it actually, they listened. So Paiste actually listened and did it.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, and I have to say that I just saw Steve Jordan playing with the Rolling Stones in Detroit in between our two episodes, and it was awesome. But for the sake of time, I'll talk about that another time. Okay. But all right. So now let's hop in here. I promise to everyone this episode is going to be shorter than an hour and a half, like the last one. So let's do our best here to keep it. You know, we got another 40 or 50 minutes. So let's jump in here, Dan, and pick it up where we left off, which was in the 1970s. And we kind of touched on getting into the 2002 series, which is very iconic with rock. So let's pick it up here and carry on the Paiste timeline.
You got it. So the period of 70-71, a lot of stuff happened, obviously, with the release of 2002s. The other thing that happened, which is really important, is what I call the great B8 shift of 1971. And that was Paiste dropped nickel silver from all their lower lines, and all their lower lines were switched over to being produced from B8. And that includes the Stamboul, the Dixie, the Super, the Ludwig Standard, the Stenopel. And you can actually find these cymbals on German eBay. They're still around. Hmm. And they're interesting. I mean, they're actually decent sounding cymbals now that they're made from B8. You know, from my personal perspective, I think they're more desirable.
Yeah.
And this, and I'm kind of inferring or making an assumption that Pisey did this a lot of ways for economic reasons, because of the fact that they were starting the production of the 2002 and they would only need two alloys now instead of three. Mm-hmm. They would just need B20 and B8. Which probably made production a little simpler.
Yeah, cleaner.
Robert knew that they needed a cymbal to compete with the amplified music of the time, which was getting louder and louder and louder when we get into the 70, 71. So that became the 2002. And it's safe to say that really the sound of 70s rock, virtually every English rock band, their drummer used Pisey cymbals. I mean, you could probably would be easier to name the drummers that didn't use 2002s throughout the 70s if they're an English band.
Seriously.
Or a European band for that matter.
Which in you know, you kind of look back, I was not born yet, but you listen to the radio, you listen to this amazing music, and it's like a lot of these bands were European, British bands at the time that we all love now. But I mean, I'm looking on the cymbal.wiki Pisty, you know, section though, and it's Bonham, Alex Van Halen, who's not born in America, but American by band. Cozy Powell, Carl Palmer, Ian Pace, Carmine Appice, let's see, Ainsley Dunbar, Keith Moon, right?
Yeah.
Steve Smith, Andy Parker of UFO, Graham Lear of Santana, Barry Moore Barlow with Jethro Tull. I mean, it just goes Charlie Watts, it's just insane. Phil Rudd, Roger Taylor. I mean, these are the biggest names. This and Nick Mason, obviously, this had to be just like pretty amazing for the Pisty family. Because I remember when on part one, we were referring to a section of their history where they were kind of down financially and they had to be making the chains for snow tires and all that stuff. I mean, this explosion had to be good for business, obviously.
Yeah. And they were, it's funny because, they didn't have much of a presence in the U.S. during this period of time. It really isn't until 1975 when Rogers took over distribution that I don't know who distributed cymbals in the U.S. from 70, 71 up until 75, if anybody. But in Europe, it wasn't a problem, you know, obviously. And, you know, this is the music I grew up on. And you know, when you listen back to all these bands, do you realize it's virtually, and most of them are Ludwig and Pisty, you know, they kind of go hand in hand.
Yeah. Yeah. Which, you know, I always thought as a kid, for some odd reason, that like Bonham played before I really looked. I mean, I'm talking like when I was like 10. I always thought Bonham played Zildjian for some odd reason. You almost think sometimes, maybe you think everyone plays Ludwig because that's what the big name that, you know, every parent knows and talks to you about. But no, it's amazing how popular Pisty was. So, and just to reiterate though, obviously these are B8 cymbals, 2002s. If you could put in a couple words, people loved these because of how clear and bright they were. Is that fair to say? Getting over the music, it cuts through. It's this new kind of rock music. Is that basically the gist of it?
Yeah, B8, especially the way they developed the 2002s. You know, I mentioned in the last podcast, I think, about in the old days, pennies were made out of copper.
Yep.
And if you take a copper penny and throw it against a hard surface like a concrete floor, you hear this really characteristic high frequency ring, and that's that ring. I also, in the old days when you had telephones, they actually had telephone bells in them. And you know, people have on their cell phones the ringtone of an old fashioned telephone.
Sure.
That telephone bell ring also reminded me of that high frequency ring that 2002s in particular have.
Mm.
And you could hear it, and that really cuts through. And there's this sweetness to the characteristics that you could hear, you know, that cuts through all the guitars and vocals and keyboards and God knows what that comes out up top. That really sounds really sweet.
Yeah. That's a great way to put it.
If I could back up a little bit, this is just little tidbits of information. One thing that's important that's really contested is Pisty serial numbers.
Okay.
And this is something I see constantly, and I've actually spent a lot of time trying to understand and gather data. Paiste did not apply serial numbers to their symbols until 1972. People constantly say, well, they did it in 1970 because the serial numbers got a zero on it. Mm. Now, that's a 1980 serial number. There was also a transition period in 71. The very early 2002s didn't have serial numbers, and they also didn't have the 2002 name on them. It just had Paiste stamped on them, and that's listed on the wiki. And 602s had the same thing where they just had the name Paiste, and it didn't say Formula 602 above it.
Gotcha.
That's what you call the transition labels or the transition symbols.
Sure.
But it's important to understand because, you know, Paiste started applying serial numbers in 72 and they were the only ones. I mean, I don't have the data, but my understanding is Zildjian didn't start doing serial numbers until the mid 90s, if that.
Wow.
So the nice thing is that you can actually date the top line Paistes, mainly 602s and 2002s. At the lower lines, it looks like more mid 70s when they started to apply serial numbers. It was hit and miss. Mm.
Yeah, that's good to know. Now, in this modern time of like, I don't know, hindsight is 2020. It's like, yeah, of course you have to have a serial number because these things are going to go out there and they're going to be valuable and people will want them. But that's good to know for dating purposes.
There's other things happening too. I mean, if we stick with the timeline, 71-ish was the creation of the Dark Ride with the cooperation of John Heisman and Jack DeJohnette. This is interesting in that they, in a lot of ways, were trying to reproduce the old K sound. So you've got a symbol that's heavily hammered and much darker sounding than the standard 602s, because this is based on a 602 symbol.
Yeah.
This is considered, from my understanding, the most valuable Paiste ever made.
Wow.
Especially the Dark Ride version. Not to get too far ahead of ourselves, but this ended up developing a whole series called the Sound Creation Series, which in 1978, which is basically, Paiste's version of, would be their K Zildjian's in a lot of ways. Most of the symbols were heavily hammered and much darker sounding. And, you know, it should be noted that this was done in 78 and released in 78 before Zildjian officially revamped or restarted their K Zildjian line in 1982.
Wow. Even more who did it first kind of.
So Paiste was definitely ahead of the curve on that.
Yeah. Cool. All right. So chugging along. Then what else in the early 70s?
Well, at some point, I think we're going to have to talk about Bonham. Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. So let's keep it. We could spend an episode on Bonham. So let's touch on Bonham a little bit. I mean, that's just obviously one of the most influential drummers in the world. I mean, of all time to this day. So the fact that he played Paiste, boy, that had to be, that's their Ringo, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Again, I've had people recently in the last few weeks send me information, which has been really helpful. There is a section on the wiki page under the Giant Beat symbols at the very bottom that has a whole section with Bonham's endorsement agreement and his inventory list that kind of lays out, what he played and when he played it. And a lot of this is with the help of a gentleman by the name of George Flutus, who is on YouTube, who's a fantastic drummer, and he's done all this research. He plays virtually every Zeppelin song and he plays them very, very well. But he's pointed out with pictures from particular eras what Bonham was playing, and it's very interesting. In a nutshell, Bonham actually played Giant Beats on more albums than he did 2002s.
Interesting.
Which I found very interesting. I mean, growing up, I always thought it was just 2002, 2002, 2002. And it turns out that he played Giant Beats all the way up through Houses of the Holy, and he was using Formula 602 hi-hats on all those early albums. Led Zeppelin 1 is really kind of anybody's guess because there just isn't any information as far as any real picture evidence around that time. It's hard to tell. But most people agree that it's a mixture of 602, Giant Beats, and Zildjian's. We also think that there was an influence from Ludwig because he got his clear maple set or a thermal gloss, I think is referred to it, in early 69, I believe, with the help of Carmine, of course.
Yep.
And it's believed that most likely Ludwig gave him a set of 602s at that time to go along with the set.
Because at that point, they would have had them.
Yeah. And they were selling and distributing them.
But
there's also proof, and there's actually an interview with Freddie Studer, who mentions that Bonham had come to the factory in very early 1970, which is it was on his inventory list, where you see he picked up a full set of Giant Beats. There's also an interview I read with Cozy Powell, where he mentioned that both him and Bonham were buddies in the late 60s, and they were on the same club circuit together playing in different bands, and they both found Giant Beats in the late 60s and were playing them. And the interesting thing they said is that they had problems with cracking their Zildjians. So when they started using Giant Beats, they found that they didn't have that issue as much or at all. And that was one of the big advantages.
Yeah, because these are heavy hitting. I mean, it's a new world of music, you know.
Wow. My understanding also is that Bonham was disappointed when they discontinued Giant Beats in 72/early 73. And he continued to play them, and he especially liked his ride, and he continued to use that ride through Physical Graffiti. So when you listen to the actual tracks recorded for that album, he's using 2002s, but he's still using his Giant Beat ride, and he toured with it. So when you look at the 75 tour, the Physical Graffiti tour, he's still using his Giant Beat ride. And it's not until Presence that he's using all 2002s.
Wow. That's awesome.
And a 602 medium ride thrown in here or there.
Man, just such a cool, I don't know, something about that sound of Zeppelin is Paiste, you know?
Yeah.
For as far as the drums go, that's so cool to know. All right. And then, like I said, there will be at some point, I don't know when, but there will be a full Bonham episode without a doubt. But yeah, was he like, I mean, you know, was he the top dog, really? I mean, I guess also we kind of like make him a legend more and more after the fact, you know, because he's been gone for so long. But did they realize at Paiste, do you think, at that time that like this guy is a big deal and we need to take care of him? Was he kind of the big dog on the endorser list?
I think a lot of it had to do with the band.
Mm-hmm. Well, of course.
The one thing, obviously, that younger listeners can't really relate to is that, I mean, really, it wasn't until the 90s that you didn't have access to these bands. And really the only way, and this is my experience as a kid, was the only way that you would hear these bands on the radio, and you'd have to wait till the song was over, then the DJ would announce who it was and like what the name of the song was, and if you're lucky, what album it was on. And I would have to go to the record store to find the album if I wanted to listen to that song and buy the album, obviously.
Yeah.
But the other thing is I would go to the supermarket and look for either Cream or Circus magazines, because that was the only way that you'd be able to actually see the band, see what they look like. And as all drummers know, it's like, what was the guy playing? I mean, that's, you know, all your idols, what was he playing? So I would page through the new issue of Cream or Circus looking for Zeppelin pictures. There was a Zeppelin article, and it's like, you know, where's the pictures of Bonham? It's like, I don't care about Plant or Page. I want to see the Bonham pictures. And usually you would see part of his set from a shot taken of Robert Plant, you know, standing in front of a set. It's like, get out of the way. I want to see Bonham's set, you know?
Yeah, totally.
So yeah, I mean, Zeppelin had this aura about them. I've read a couple different biographies. They were very groundbreaking in that. They changed the way business was done in the industry, especially with performing live. But more importantly, they didn't do interviews. They didn't release singles. There was only Zeppelin only ever released one single. But the main thing was that they had really bad reception from the press very early on, Rolling Stone. And they decided that they weren't going to cater to the media. So they were non-existent. So they became this very mythical band. And I think that really drove that aura about them and their popularity, the fact that they were so inaccessible.
Yeah.
And that really drove a lot of their popularity, the fact that you didn't know anything about them. And there were never no interviews. You know, all you saw were pictures in magazines. So for young fans, you know, they had a rabid following. So I'm sure Paiste, in some former men or knew about that. Obviously, they were very popular in Europe, you know?
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Yeah. It, obviously, cool. they had a lot of other top endorsees, but as far as volume, the amount of albums sold, or the amount of tickets sold for concerts, you know, Zeppelin was number one.
Yeah, for sure, you know, which is important.
Especially in the U.S.
Yeah, absolutely. Which, perfect segue, getting back to the U.S., distribution. Let's talk about Rogers, and who was owned by CBS.
Yeah.
And it's interesting, kind of reading on the wiki here, talking about how part of the deal was Paiste would distribute Rogers drums in Switzerland. So there was a bit of a back and forth, because these are such distant places where they needed help, obviously, to have feet on the ground in those places. So it makes sense. Let's talk about the distribution here a little bit. How did that all go?
Well, I could tell you really from a personal perspective, because this is when I started playing. You know, I started playing the drums in 78, and I got my first Paiste in 79. I got a 404 16-inch crash. And my experience, and also from looking at catalogs and whatnot, Rogers first listed 2002s in their 76 catalog. So initially, they only offered 2002s. As you get later into the 70s, you'll see that they do offer Sound Creations. And by 78, which is when the Dixie and the Stamboul are discontinued, they basically morphed into the 505 and the 404. Rogers did offer the 404, and that's where I came in. Mm. But what was very interesting is once I started to work on the wiki and started to contact people in Europe and make friends and this and that, I found that there was all these cymbals that were available in Europe that we never got. You know, I mean, we never got Stamboul's or Dixies here in the U.S., let alone, I mean, what we got was through Ludwig, which would have been the standard, where they also produced an even less expensive line called the Stenopel in the late 60s, early 70s. But that was it. Now, Rogers, for whatever reason, didn't distribute 602s in the U.S. On one of their price lists from 1980, they list the 602s is a special order, and it takes a 100-day turnaround to basically deliver the cymbal. So the selection was limited. Even the sizes available of 2002s were limited in the U.S. compared to what they had in Europe. Hmm. So Rogers still did very well as far as the volume of the amount of cymbals they sold, obviously. I don't really know why they stopped. I would assume it was because Paiste came to the realization of, well, geez, you know, if we're doing this well in the U.S., we might as well set up a distribution center and do it ourselves, which would make a lot of sense, which is what they did in 1981.
Yeah, which there's something, you know, it's sort of going down the same path. Obviously, it didn't end the same way, but with Ludwig, about kind of latching on a little bit to a successful drum company to get, you know, reach a wider audience and have the distribution and stuff. But yeah, I guess at that point with their, it was different than the earlier Ludwig distribution, obviously, because they were bigger and more well-known with these bands. So they probably did feel more confident to take that step out on their own to, you know, we can do this on our own.
And I think by the late 70s, Paiste was doing pretty well with the 2002s.
Yeah.
I don't have the source. I honestly can't remember where this statement came from, but I did read a statement a long time ago that Rogers or CBS actually did more volume with Paiste than they did with Rogers drums. In other words, they sold more in dollar wise, more made more money off the 2002s or gross dollars than they did off of the actual Rogers drums.
Wow.
Which is pretty crazy.
Yeah, but I mean, I kind of get it.
That's the case.
In some, like I remember I used to work at Guitar Center in the drum department, and it was like, yeah, you sell more sticks than you do Tama Bubinga drum sets.
Yeah.
You know? Like people are going to buy more cymbals than they are going to buy a full drum set. So,
yeah.
But I'm sure Rogers was kind of like, geez, why are we selling? You know, it's just an interesting dichotomy, I guess you could say.
Here's another thing to keep in mind, too, is number one, all there was Zildjian and Paiste in the U.S.
Yeah.
I do know, I have a catalog, a Gretsch catalog from 1980, where they actually distribute UFIPs.
Hmm.
And you see these little, when I was growing up, you would have these kind of funky off-brand symbols. I mean, one of the things that floated around is the kids in my neighborhood. I remember one kid had a Camber symbol. Mm-hmm. Another kid had a Coret symbol. But as far as entry-level symbols go, they were kind of, one, they weren't very good.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think one of the major advantages Paiste had was, even though it was only the 404, they were selling probably a lot of 404s in the U.S. because, you know, Zildjian didn't have a second line of symbols. You know,
sure.
All they had were A Zildjians all through the 70s and the 60s. You know, I mean, I know that there was the ASCO plant and they did start to produce Ks, I think, at 78. But my understanding is that the companies really weren't connected. I mean, Zildjian didn't offer Ks in their catalog until around 82.
No. And I think part of the split, you know, again, sorry if I'm wrong, there's a lot of history. Part of the split between Robert and Armand was, I believe, one of them wanted to have a second, less expensive line, and the other one didn't. And I can't remember if exactly, I think it was Zildjian. I think Robert didn't want to have a cheaper line, and Armand wanted to start to lower and get into that later in the 80s, obviously, was when that would be. This episode is brought to you by Dream Symbols. Dream Symbols is continuing the tasting tour 2021 with a couple new dates I wanted to let you guys know about. Saturday, November 27th, they'll be at Portman's Music Superstore in Savannah, Georgia. If you haven't heard, they're going to have a lot of cool symbols in store. They're going to have a member of the Dream Team on site, and they'll be doing the recycling program. Go check it out. This episode is brought to you by Forks Drum Closet, Nashville's full-line drum store. Celebrating its 40th year in business, Forks is independently owned and operated in the heart of Music City. Specializing in drums and percussion, Forks offers great discounts on all major brands and will beat any retailer's advertised price. From new and used equipment, vintage drums, and marching and orchestral instruments, Forks has something for every drummer. They also offer professional rental, repair and restoration services, as well as drum lessons. Stop by their storefront at 308 Chestnut Street, Nashville, Tennessee. Call 615-383-8343 or go online at ForksDrumCloset.com. All right, so you mentioned this earlier. They were going to have their own distribution center. And I just want to, like, let's do a little check-in on Europe. So we still have the German factory, and we still have the Swiss factory, correct?
That's correct. German factory is producing all the B8 lines, including 2002s, but it's the domestic market. It's Germany and most likely Central Europe only. During that period, you'll never see any 70s German Paistes in the U.S. You know, it was only Switzerland. Switzerland was the only one that exported their symbols to the U.S. or North America through that period. Now, I believe in the 80s, I think we did start to get some German lower line Paiste symbols. Gotcha. I would have to find proof of it, which would be difficult, but I believe that is the case.
Yeah.
But in the 70s, no. And what's interesting is that there's one gentleman that I actually contacted me, and he has this enormous collection. He's got all these 505s and Stambuls, and he has all these 505s from the late 70s. And I'm like, I can't believe, I didn't know they made all this. You know, they made a marching China type.
Wow.
You know, and I'm looking at this thing, this is so cool. It's like, we never got this. We didn't get any marching cymbals. We didn't get any hand cymbals. There's a little excerpt at the bottom of the price list saying hand cymbals available on request, which basically means special order.
Yeah, sure.
But they don't tell you what's available. You know, I didn't know that you could get 602 concert sound edges.
Yeah, that's interesting. It kind of makes me think of like when you see like car companies who make cars in Europe that, as here in America, we've never even heard of or seen, or in Asia, where it's like Ford or something, they make these things that literally we'll never see or drive ever. It's super similar to that. So, all right, while we're over in Europe checking in, so we still, Robert, Tumas, everyone, they're still running the show. The family is still very much in charge, right? No one has been sold to another company or anything. It's still a family operation.
Now, also one more thing about the German factory, my understanding was that, you know, Father Paiste passed away in 63, and Mother Paiste, which would be Robert and Tumas's mother, took over in some form or manner of running the factory in Germany. And I'm sure she, in some ways, at some point became more of a figurehead, but she lived in that little house next door to the factory until she passed away.
Wow.
So I thought that was very interesting. It's, you know, all in the family.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
My understanding is when Eric visits a German factory, that's where he stays.
Oh, cool.
And is in his in grandmother's house.
Wow. That's cool. All right, then let's pick up back there and kind of go from the 70s into the 80s. And correct me if I'm missing anything, but let's maybe jump. Let's hear about the distribution center or if there's any other lines along the way there.
Well, I already kind of mentioned it, but the Sound Creation series was released in 78.
Yeah.
And it's kind of a mysterious series. It was very expensive. But I own several Sound Creation cymbals, and I have to tell you that I absolutely love the Sound Creation series, and there's a lot of like really hardcore Sound Creation fans that want Paisley to bring them back. But honestly, the 602 Modern Essentials series is really kind of the grandson of Sound Creation in a lot of ways. That was the same general intent, was to make a more exotic, darker, deeper sounding type of cymbal. And again, they're basically 602s that have been heavily hammered.
Yeah.
And the sound changed quite a bit, but I still love the Sound Creation series, and there's quite a few of them still around. And the Dark Ride continued all the way through the 70s and 80s with the Sound Creation series. And the Sound Creation series and the 602s were discontinued in 94 because Swiss Metal ran into financial difficulties and they stopped producing B20. So for people out there wondering why they stopped producing these cymbals, that's the reason why.
Wow. You know, it's just it's obviously a thing. It's the cymbal companies rely so much on the, you know, metal manufacturers that controls a lot. There's a lot of forces at play that can affect, the creation of a line or a cymbal. It's like, well, we can't do it anymore. We lost our distributor. So that's just an interesting side note.
Brea Distribution Center. So Brea is pretty much due east, a little southeast of downtown Los Angeles. So I was really happy that they decided to establish the distribution center here because it was close to me.
Yeah, for sure.
What I can tell you from a personal perspective was I grew up here. I moved back east for 3 years from 79 to 82. And then I was back here in the summer of 82. So Brea had really just got up and running by then. And I was buying my Paisties back east. And I had bought a 404. Then I moved up to 2002s. And it was very difficult. I had to drive into Boston. Well, I had to get my dad or my parents to drive into Boston in order to go to a music store to buy them. And the selection was pretty thin, you know. But I very strongly remember when we moved out here in the summer of 82, the first thing I did was hit the music stores. And of course there was Guitar Center, which was the old school Guitar Center. I mean, it was ground zero for Paisley. And I can remember walking into the old Guitar Center before they moved it in Hollywood. And the drum section, the center of the drum section was this huge Paisley display. And they had a percussion set. If the listeners know what that is. And they had racks and racks of 2002s. And this is when they did the color label shift.
Yeah.
In 81. So no more black labels, they're all colored labels. They had green label 505s. They had brown label 404s. They had a ton of 2002s. And oh my God, a 602. I saw my first 602 for the first time, you know? And I think they even had Sound Creations. And I knew what everything was because I had the catalogs, but I had never seen this stuff in person. This also coincides with what I like to call the beginning of the hair metal phase in LA. And so the Sunset Strip, and that was ground zero for all those hair metal bands like Rat and Quiet Riot and Motley Crue and Poison. All those bands all originated out of that area. And the majority of those guys all play Paisley. They all play 2002s. And I think a lot of it had to do with the fact that Paisley had such a strong presence now in the U.S. and especially in L.A. And now all of a sudden you've got MTV within about a year or less of Paisley establishing their distribution center. So now all of a sudden you've got these drummers. You know, I vividly remember that Rat video constantly playing on MTV, and yeah, you can clearly see the drummers playing 2002s. You could see the Red Label Paiste underneath the cymbals. So, you know, they got free advertising. You know, they got huge exposure in the US because of that. So
totally.
Again, this is my impression.
Yeah.
I really think that they really blew up in the US. I mean, the US is such a gigantic market.
Totally.
Another thing that's really, really important, if we back up just a year, was Paiste released the Rude series in 1980. And that was, you know, their unlathed cymbals. And again, that was Paiste, you know, being innovative and producing these cymbals for metal, punk rock, really, really loud music.
Sure.
And probably one of the main endorsees that everybody knows about is Stuart Copeland. And he started using Rudes on Ghost of the Machine. And you could hear them. He's actually mixing 602s and Rudes, which is pretty crazy, but it works. And that also was the incentive for the colored label era, because Paiste had printed the big white Rude label on the cymbal. And that basically started the whole era of now they're going to actually print big logos on the cymbals in color, which are easy to see.
Totally.
And it's free advertising.
Yeah. And oh my God. I mean, that the colored look, I mean, I consider myself a bit of like an outsider. Again, you are like the Paiste expert, but I just have to say that the colored logos, even getting further down a little bit, the actual literally colored symbols, which I'm sure we'll talk about, but those colors, I just think of that red 2002. And I used to have a 2002 Crash. Man, it just pops. It is such a unique, and that green on the 505, it's so just, it draws your eye to it. And it's like, this is different. And it makes sense that it's because, you know, there's music videos, there's all the stuff, they know advertising, and that's really effective.
And another interesting note is Zildjian didn't start to label their symbols or put their logo, which they call the hollow logo on the bottom of their symbols, until I believe 1978, which Paiste started in 72.
Gotcha.
And I think in 81-ish or 82 is when Zildjian went to the solid black logo on the bottom of the symbols. But this is my interpretation, that I believe Paiste led the way again with this. And they continued innovating. I mean, it was, you know, the percussion set was absolutely, I remember seeing it, and it had the most odd things in it. You know, the roto sound and cup chimes and these little tiny gongs, a sound plate, this big rectangular piece of bronze, you know, the bell cymbal, obviously the flat ride. I mean, it goes on and on and on. But probably one of the biggest things that really defines the 80s is the color sound cymbals.
Yeah. For sure. God, that sticks out. Even today, you see a lot of red. I always typically see drummers with like red drums, red heads, red cymbals. It's like, it's super cool looking. I mean, I've never actually played them. How do you think they stand up quality wise? Because someone might look at it and go like, oh, that's a gimmick. The cymbal can't be that great. You know, how do you like them?
Well, my understanding is that there were 2002s.
Sure.
And you could tell from the lathing, because 2002s have a very distinct type of lathing where it's asymmetrical. It gets tight and then it widens out, and then it gets tight again, then it widens out. It's kind of like the grooves of a record, and you have these kind of wide areas between songs, if that makes sense.
Yeah, yeah.
My understanding is what Paiste did was they had to produce an extra bright version of the 2002s, and then they coated it with a lacquer for the color, and that tended to dampen the cymbal and dull it down. So they pre-emphasized the brightness to counteract the fact that it was going to be muted and duller sounding. And it was the era of MTV, and you see all these new wave bands, especially from England, these guys are playing color sounds, and it falls right in with the whole visual aspect of the big 80s, with the hair and the big clothes and the makeup, and you know, everything was bright and shiny and new and neon and technology, and you know, it's another innovation,
you know. Yeah, totally.
Really, you know, and they were wildly popular. I mean, they're all over the place. I remember every week a new video would come out from some new band, and hey, the guy's playing Color Sounds, you know?
Yeah, totally. Did the color with the lacquer, was the technology figured out right away? You know, I mean, did they have it buttoned up, or did they start to like chip off, or were they pretty, you know, durable?
As far as I know, I mean, if you clean the Sybil, if you use an abrasive cleaner, the lacquer will come off. You'll see it. It'll start to work just like the labels themselves, the colored labels.
Yes.
If you use an abrasive cleaner, what will happen is the high spots will wear out first, which is areas that are between the lathing grooves that stick, that stand proud or stick up higher mm-hmm. on the Sybil. Those will be worn out first. So you'll see that on old Color Sounds. You have to be really careful not use a really abrasive cleaner. The other thing about the Color Sounds is, again, I a little quip that I saw was supposedly Nick Mason had asked Pisey to produce all white cymbals for him.
Cool.
For the Wall Tour in 1980.
Wow.
Now, I've never seen any pictures of that, of him playing white cymbals, but supposedly that may have been the spark or the beginning of the idea of actually applying a colored lacquer to the cymbals.
Yeah, I mean, Nick Mason, man. I mean, he having a big player like that could really pull some weight. So, all right, so color, and then let's keep chugging along here, because we're close. I mean, we're in the 80s. I feel like it you know, we're in the, it says on the wiki here a couple times that we're still in the golden era, the second golden era. Is that pretty true? I mean, this would be the rise of the 2002s and all that stuff. Is that kind of what constitutes the quote unquote golden era?
Yeah, that's kind of my personal little thing that I like saying, that, you know, because this is the era that I grew up with, and I was playing drums, and, you know, again, this is pre-Sabian. I mean, Sabian didn't really come onto the scene until 83, as I knew, but I found out the details from listening to your Andy Zildjian podcast, which is mm-hmm. great.
Yeah, thank you.
But yeah, I you know, it was, and you know, again, my personal point of view was, Zildjian was kind of resting on their laurels, and Pisey had all these, you know, new young bands, and the music style had changed, the look had changed, and Pisey was right there, you know, right in the moment, you know, supplying what needed, what the, you know, new bands wanted or needed.
Totally.
One of the big things that happened too during this era, if we go to 86, is what I call the great phase out. And that is when Pisey did a major shift and discontinued a whole bunch of their lines. And in some ways, they semi-discontinued the 2002. But there's a story I have behind this. And again, you kind of have to be around my age. A lot of younger listeners don't realize that there used to be a different Coke.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. There is in 85, I was working in a liquor store, and the new Coke came out. And what Coca-Cola had determined that people needed a new flavor. And there was all this competition. They used to do these taste tests with Pepsi and how everybody preferred Coke. But for whatever reason, they decided, their marketing department over has decided, you know what, we need a new flavor. We're going to retire the quote unquote old Coke, and we're going to come out with the new Coke. Well, the new Coke was softer tasting. It didn't have the snap that the old Coke had, and it failed miserably. Now there's a parallel to that with the 3000 line. And the 3000 was supposed to be the replacement, or was the replacement for the 2002. And in Robert's interview, he talks about how he didn't think the 2002 would last into the 80s. Mm. And they were always striving for new sounds and new development. And he felt at that time that it was time to design a new cymbal to replace the 2002 to keep up with the current music trends. So the 3000 was very similar to the 2002. And I actually owned one along with all my 2002s. So I was able to do an A-B comparison every time I played the drums. And what I noticed was it was a more aggressive sounding cymbal. It had a stronger mid-range. They had larger bells relative to the 2002s. And it had this odd lathing that was very flat and shallow compared to the deeper grooves you would see on the 2002. And the 3000 kind of really went the same way as the new Coke. You know, people, I'm sure they were popular, but what happened was that as soon as the 3000 came out, there was this big demand for 2002s. And Paiste was trying to move away from the 2002 and focus their production on the 3000. They couldn't because people kept asking for 2002s.
Yeah.
So the 2002 continued through that whole period while the 3000, the 2000, the 1400, and the 200s were produced. The other factor that was part of this was, and again, this was in an interview I read with either Robert Tumas, was the 404 and the 505, especially the 505, was too expensive to produce. The 505 production-wise is so close to the 2002 that I'm making the educated guess that Paiste was not making any money off of it, or maybe even losing money. The amount of labor involved to produce that cymbal was almost the same amount of labor it took to produce a 2002, yet in the catalog, they were 30% cheaper.
Yeah, so it just doesn't work.
Yeah, and again, remember, these cymbals, they're hammered, they're machine hammered, they're manually machine hammered into shape. So they have the same manufacturing process as the 2002s, the 602s, and the Sound Creations. You know, the big difference is the amount of lathing. You know, there's little things here and there that they will omit to bring the amount of labor down to reduce the cost. But with the 505, they're just, you know, they would have to raise the price a substantial amount. So instead, what they did was they transitioned to this new series, and the 1000 was supposed to be the replacement for the 505. But construction wise, the 2000 was really the 505, but the 2000 was more expensive, if that makes sense.
It's funny because it's just a ton of numbers, but I think it does make sense. I mean, it makes me think too, with like the whole taking the 2002s away and thinking we got to innovate, that can sometimes be the double-edged sword of being such an innovative company, where it's like you're doing, you know, the color sound cymbals and you're doing all these things and the other companies are kind of copying you a couple of years later to keep up with you. But it's almost like you can't forget what people really like with your classic lines, like the 2002 and such, you know, where it's like, don't take them away, keep them going.
One of the other driving forces too, is my understanding is that 2002 sales numbers would start to drop. So, you know, Paiste looks at their sales numbers and said, okay, well, 2002 is losing popularity. You know, it's not fitting with the times, with the styles of music that are out now. So let's develop something new. So they develop something new and release it. And then the customers are like, well, wait a second. We like 2002s. We want to keep, don't discontinue them. So all of a sudden, demand shoots way back up again. So the price says, okay, geez, all right, well, we got to go back.
Yeah. You know, honestly, it's funny because I think that same thing. I remember listening to some podcast or something about the history of Coke, and it talked about that, about how once new Coke went away and old Coke came back, numbers skyrocketed, where it's like, it's almost like a you create a rush on the market with your own taking your popular product away and then bringing it back. It's that's got to be a business tactic. I don't think they did that as much as like a, you know, just a lucky happenstance of like, oh no, it's back, and then they sell a bunch. But definitely an interesting further parallel to New Coke. So all right, on your timeline here, 86 is really kind of where it stops. And even on Paiste's website, it goes 81 to today. It basically says, looking at Paiste's history on their website, the company gains a firm foothold in the world's largest musical instrument market with the establishment of Paiste's America, of Paiste America in California, which we talked about. Tumas's son, Eric Paiste, is sent there in the late 80s to look after Paiste's U.S. operations. In 2003, Eric assumes overall responsibility for the family's business. So Eric Paiste gets involved in the 80s and then takes over in 03, which it's in the family. Who is Eric's, you may have said this before, but who is Eric's father?
He's the son of Tumas.
Okay. Or
I was recently contacted and somebody mentioned that the traditional pronunciation is Tumas.
Tumas. Okay.
So okay. I don't know which is correct, so we can go either way.
Yeah, both. Yeah, but it's good to say them both.
The one thing that is really important with the timeline, post 86 was the Paiste Signature Series and the Signature Alloy. And again, this is another innovation with Robert, where they were starting to see issues with Swiss Metal in the 80s, as far as I believe their financial status. Again, I can't be more specific than that, but I think they were kind of on shaky ground by the time you get to the mid to late 80s.
Yeah.
So that may have been part of an incentive for Robert to develop a bespoke new alloy. And the intention was to replace the B-20 symbols, and specifically the 602, but also to make something new that was quote-unquote better, you know, than the 602, and maybe take the best qualities of B8 and B20 and combine them into a new alloy, which will give you both, you know, the classic sound of B20 and then the nice high end that B8 has. And you end up with really what is B15. I mean, I've looked at the patent for the signature alloy, and they state something like 14.8 to 15.2% tin. So it's basically B15.
Which you don't you don't hear about those different, you hear about B8 and you hear about B20. You don't hear about the other Bs, you know?
So again, this is, you know, Paiste innovation. It's amazing that they would come up with something like this. And the story goes that Robert had tried several different mixtures, B10, B12, B15, you know, yada, yada, yada. And he found that he liked the sonic qualities of the B15 alloy the best. You know, they were producing, they would make a symbol out of these different alloys. And this is what he really liked. So he decided to go with this. Now, my understanding, not to get too technical, is if you stay below B12, which is 12% tin, the alloy is what's called single phase, which means that the copper and tin are completely mixed together. And there's no issues with rolling, which is the advantage of B8, the fact that it can be rolled cold and it's relatively easy to produce. But once you get above B12, you get into the B20 range, where you have to do all of this heating and cooling and tempering and then reheating to roll it, and then heat it. Every time you roll it, you have to heat it up and be very careful with the temperatures and very precise. So B15 falls into this range. It's somewhere in between that they still need to have a hot rolling stage at some point and roll it hot, but the last stage you can roll it cold. And I have this crazy story from Fritz, where Fritz was actually involved with Weiland Works, who was producing the B15. And they originally had the B15 produced, I believe, in the Czech Republic. And they had all these issues, and their very early signatures were actually produced with this alloy, and they had a lot of cracking problems. And they moved the production to Weiland Works in Germany, and they did some tweaking on how they produced the alloy, and they were able to produce an alloy that was much more stable and reliable. But Fritz told me the final process, when they do the last cold rolling stages, the alloy actually cracks on the surface. You get the surface cracking. And what they have to do is they have to machine or grind off 20% from each side to grind down past the cracking area. So you lose 40% of your material right off the top before you're actually even able to make a symbol out of it. So he said this is the reason why signatures were so expensive, especially in the beginning when they were released, was the cost to produce the alloy was more expensive than B20, actually. Now, the question is, why? Why would they do this? Well, because B15 had the sound that Robert wanted. This is what he wanted. And it really was, you have to produce this at any cost, because this is what works. So, you know, the next time you're playing any kind of B15 symbol, you know, if it's a traditional or a signature or anything like that, just know that there was a lot of hard work in producing that symbol and that alloy.
Totally. You know,
it's very special.
Yeah, even the development of figuring that out, of like how much to shave off and all this stuff, it's just insane. But that's Paiste in a nutshell right there.
Well, and their partner Weiland Works, who took over with the producing of all their alloys.
Totally.
Has been very good. And that's also, you know, part of the industry, the fact that they're using, you know, a large, you know, foundry mill that has a lot of experience, and it's not a home brew type of production. They're using what the best term could be is the scientific process. So they're very, very accurate with their production and the process, and very consistent with that alloy.
Yeah, totally. Man, so we're getting obviously close to the end here, and I've promised people we won't have another, as much as people might want, 3 hours total of Paiste history. We'll keep it relatively shorter. But so talk a little bit about, as we wrap up, the new B-20, and I know our friend Fritz Steger was involved in it. So what's the deal with that?
So I believe it was 2011 when the new 602s were released. I could be wrong on that, mm-hmm. on the release date. And then, of course, there's Vinny Caliuta with the Modern Essentials, which I was blown away when I saw that. I mean, I couldn't believe they got Vinny.
Yeah, for sure.
Paiste got Vinny. I can't believe this. You know, they might as well have gotten Buddy Rich to endorse them.
Totally. Really.
So my understanding from talking to Fritz, he actually had firsthand involvement with this. Weiland Works was producing B8 for Paiste. You know, Swiss Metal was gone by 94, was out of the picture. And Weiland Works is producing a B8, and they're producing the B15 for Paiste. And Weiland, on their own, decided, you know, we're gonna take a run at producing B20, and we're gonna offer it to all the modern cymbal companies, which would have been Meinl, Paiste, Sabian, and Zildjian. So there was a book published in 1937 by a doctor, a PhD, a metallurgist, who did a scientific analysis and research of how you produce B20. You know, the temperature it's melted, how it's mixed, what temperatures you need to heat the material to before you roll it, how quickly you cool it. You know, I mean, and you know how the Germans are. I mean, they're so good with industry and so specific with these types of things. So he basically wrote a recipe book, a cookbook on how to make B20. So this is common knowledge, I guess, in the industry. And Weiland went through the book, and they had their own metallurgists, and they produced B20 again, according to the cookbook. So they would produce this quote unquote perfect form of B20. And from conversations with Fritz and his conversations with Weiland Works, he found that the reason why 602s had a particular sound and they don't sound like Zildjian and Sabians, a lot of it has to do with the manufacturing of the alloy itself. That is one of the big factors in why 602s sound the way they do. And as Fritz referred to it as the quote unquote hi-fi sound. And a lot of that is 602s have that sweet, crisp high end that Zildjian and Sabians don't have. So long story short, Weiland starts to shop around the B20, and they take it to Paiste, and you know, Paiste is just about to start the production of the Master Series. So they've got foundries in Turkey that are actually producing the B20 form. So they're not interested. So Weiland at some point contacts Fritz, and I believe Fritz helps Weiland contact Meinl, and Fritz brings some blanks to Meinl and says, hey, check this out. Here's a new B20 that Weiland is producing. And Meinl says, oh, this is interesting. Okay, let's check it out. And Meinl produced, and I believe in the early 2000s or mid-2000s, what was called the M series. And that was their B20 line that they produced from Meinl's B20 alloy. Fritz went to do his interview with Robert Paiste, I believe, in 2006, and he brought the blanks with him, the B20 blanks from Weiland Works. And I don't know exactly change, but Fritz told me that while or before or during the conversation, he mentioned to Robert, hey, by the way, I've got these B20 blanks. And Robert says, well, what are you talking about? He said, let me show them to you. So Robert was very interested. He says, yes, leave them with me. So he liked them. Fritz told me there were some minor changes they made, but that was the basis for the reissue 602s and the Modern Essentials. Now, Weiland also shopped that B20 to Sabian and Zildjian. And Sabian and Zildjian both turned them down. And to quote Fritz, Sabian and Zildjian told Weiland, we're not interested because we could produce it here cheaper. which makes sense because it's very expensive to produce things in Germany. You know, the labor costs and whatnot, and obviously one's going to mark it up. But it would be funny that either Zildjian and or Sabian, if they decided to use that B20, they would use the same alloy that was being used both by Mono and Paiste. I thought that would be very funny. That would be a very interesting scenario.
Yeah. Oh my god. Wow. So, it's so cool how involved Fritz is and, you know, has been with this stuff. I mean, it just goes to show that someone like him, I feel lucky that he has provided so much information, and along with all the other people we've mentioned in the first episode, really to make this history possible, because it's kind of tough to put it all together. And like we did with the opening, housekeeping kind of thing of this, of it's still sort of evolving and new information is coming out, along the way. So man, it's just unbelievable. And as people are probably figuring out that it's like, we were pretty heavy on the early, you know, era, and then, you know, early 1900s through, you know, the 80s. And I'm sure there's still plenty of other stuff to cover, but really that's kind of our sweet spot is up till like 90s and stuff. And you just obviously touched about on later stuff there, but I think it's fair to say that it was business as usual then. And with Eric Paiste running the company, everything seems to be going very, very smoothly. And they're just an absolutely dominant force in the symbol world today. I mean, there's no denying that.
Yeah. And you know, they continue to innovate. I mean, it's hard for me to keep track of all the different lines they produce. And I mean, that's the Paiste way. You know, Paiste has always found a way to be innovative and creative. And it's, you know, it just never ceases to amaze me. And they're still catering to the modern taste of musicians, what musicians are interested in. And you see that with the Masters and 20 series, where they've got, you know, very dark, very earthy sounded cymbals, which people are really into now. They've got a lot of really trashy noise making type of cymbals with like PSTX.
Yeah.
You know, I love the fact that they're producing giant beats and 602s and the modern essential 602s. And obviously they're still producing 2002s. You know, those are all my old school favorites. So, you know, I'm glad that Paiste really has something to offer to literally everybody.
Absolutely. That's a great way to put it. There's something for everyone. Maybe if you're listening to this and you are like a player of one of the other brands, go out and get some Paiste cymbals. Cause obviously they're unbelievable, but I think most people have played them and know just how great they are. But cool. Well, Dan, let's tell people here. Well, first off, thanks to everyone who's listened to both episodes all the way through. That's a whole lot of Paiste content. You're like at over 2.5, almost 3 hours of Paiste history, which I think is really cool. I was, like I said, very surprised at like the day I released it, how many people were like, this episode was great. Can't wait for part two. so they seemed to, everyone seemed to enjoy it. So I hope everyone liked this one too. Let's just tell people, I think the best way to see a lot of your documentation of all this would be on symbol.wiki, and click the Paiste tab there and you can go and see a lot of this. And it's pretty obvious, but you can go to paiste.com, paiste.com. And then you can see, you know, everything Paiste is doing today. And I've met a few folks at Paiste, like I mentioned in the first one, and they're just super nice people, and I'm just so happy that I could finally do an episode about Paiste itself.
A word about the wiki. The one thing I want to mention, and I mentioned at the beginning of this part of the podcast, is, you know, the wiki is ever expanding, ever growing, and there's always updates and changes. So, you know, obviously I try to be as accurate as possible, and a lot of times you'll see question marks or asterisks next to a particular date or a statement. And that's because a lot of times it's hard to produce any kind of hard evidence. And some of it is word of mouth. You know, this person talked to so-and-so at Paiste and this is what they said. So, you know, take what you read with a grain of salt, and that we've made our best effort to be as accurate as possible. And I've got some great sources. Obviously the knowledge I gained from Fritz has been exponential, you know, and it's been really hard to digest all of it.
Yeah.
But you know, we, you know, the people that work on the wiki have made a really, really hard effort to try to be accurate. There was a lot of detail stuff. I originally got involved with this because I wanted to collect Pisces. That's how I got involved with the wiki, and I want to learn more about the history and what would be an interesting symbol to buy, not necessarily for value, but more just, I was really interested in their B8 history.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how I really got involved with the wiki, and I got sucked in, you know.
Yeah, totally.
And it was just a case of more and more and more. The more I learned, the more I wanted to know, and you know, it's fascinating. But the information is hard to come by, especially if you go back before the 70s, and especially before the war. The information is virtually non-existent. So
yeah.
That said, I mean, virtually anything, especially when you're looking to try to date a symbol, it's really important with the prices people are asking now for symbols, and a warning that there are people out there that are trying to sell, you know, lower level symbols. I've seen a few people will try to sell like nickel silver Ludwig standards and ask, you know, $350 for it. And it's no, this is, you know, a mid, lower, even entry level symbol, and it's not worth $350. So sure. It's important to understand what you're looking at and to date it and to know what model it was and, you know, its intrinsic value. And, are you really willing to pay that much? But
yeah.
That being said, that is some of the incentive behind producing the wiki, you know, is education. So people understand, you know, what Pisces are, what, where they came from, how they got to where they are now. You know, it's a rich history.
Absolutely.
And a fascinating history.
Yeah, totally. Which isn't over. There's plenty of Pisces to come. It's not going anywhere. So,
yeah.
All right. Well, again, thank you to everyone who we mentioned in the last episode. I mean, I guess real quick, we'd say, like, I think Steve Black, I believe you said Todd Little, right? Was a big help to you. Fritz Steger, Raphael Zimmerman. Let's see, Tim Shahady from Pisces, who talked to me a little bit at some of the shows and stuff. And obviously, Dan, thank you very much. So again, everyone, Dan Garza has been our amazing guest and our guide through the history of Pisces for this 2-part mega episode. So Dan, thank you so much for doing this and just really taking all this time and effort and redoing things and finding stuff. It's just been amazing. So I really appreciate you getting this Pisces history out in public and letting me be the way you did it. I'm honored. So thank you for being here.
Thank you.
If you like this podcast, find me on social media at Drum History and please share, rate, and leave a review. And let me know topics that you would like to learn about in the future. Until next time, keep on learning.